joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse. As always, wishing you the best on behalf of myself, Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse. You can always find us at naturalnurse.com and Dr. Eugene Zamperone. We have so many exciting events coming up. I'm going to update the schedule today on naturalnurse.com. The first event that's coming up is Chinatown. We have two Chinatown walks every single year. They're always sold out, and we have just a few spaces left in the next Chinatown trip, so you can come on, find out about that. We also have many classes in herbal identification, outside herbal identification, now that it's the spring. And you can come along on any of those, as well as online herbal certification courses, and both online and in office in Oyster Bay, New York, private consultations. So go to naturalnurse.com to get in touch about any of those things that you might be interested in. Today, we have as our guest Mr. Ken Snyder. Ken is an occupational therapist, massage therapist, and medical and healthcare advocate. He has worked with people having a wide variety of healthcare needs, including inpatient psychiatry and substance abuse, adults with developmental delays, and multiple physical handicaps in residential and day program settings, children with learning challenges in public schools, and on Native American reservations, and with physical challenges in the rehabilitation clinics. He has provided presentations, trainings, and play shops on topics ranging from on-site massage, stress, task, and mind management, and the evolution of consciousness, and also is involved with nonviolent communication, NVC. He optimizes the satisfaction we derive from our activities of daily living through these presentations. And also, he is offering quality of life extension services to those dealing with end of life issues and their family. And he's very involved in traversing the United States to inspire action on the climate crisis, or thinking about how our complicity is involved with it. He's also very busy meeting with government representatives working to draft resolutions to oppose the fast-tracking of several dubious international trade agreements, such as TTP and TAFTA, which we're going to be focusing on in our discussion today. So thank you so much for joining us today, Ken.
Thank you for having me, Ellen.
Let's go back in time a little bit. I know it's not that little a bit, but it's a ways back to when you were a youngster, a young man, and even a little boy. What do you think led you on this path, which is a path of, I would say, higher consciousness and being the watcher, both of yourself and the environment?
Well, you know, I think we all have our predispositions to start with, but I think the way I understand it really is, you know, just looking at my family and my dad, and you know, very early on, very early age, I was very curious about what motivates people, you know, what moves people to do anything, you know, what we do, and that kind of did initially bring me on the path of motivation, stress management. How we develop thoughts and thought patterns, and you know, and then later on, you know, these life energies within us, you know, these human needs that you know, we seek to fulfill. You know, we develop kind of sophisticated ways of thinking about things and strategies for meeting these needs. But on the subconscious level, it's really you know, these energetic, universal human needs that that move us to do just about everything. So, you know, in that respect, that's really got me into occupational therapy. But my interest in occupational therapy really was in the realm of psychological and emotional health. And, you know, and OT really is a very holistic profession. It has to do with not just work. People associate occupation with work in Western society. Really has to do with what we do, you know, what we do with our time, how we occupy our time. And that encompasses both the physical, the mental, the emotional, and the spiritual, and the cultural as well. And so, you know, I really became interested, if I was interested in primary prevention and holism, looking at everything that involves meeting and satisfying the needs of humans. And we look at the context in which human beings function. It's not just our immediate environment, but it's also the natural environment, the natural world, where we came from originally and where our universal human needs evolved out of. So it all kind of has a very organic and natural evolution from just being interested in what moves us to do what we do and where motivation comes from, and making these connections with energies within our bodies, our thinking minds, our connection with our environment and other people, and how we negotiate all that, and how we strategize to meet our needs, and how we work this dilemma, this human condition out, you know, between our individual selves and other people and our environments. And then it gets kind of tricky here as we join groups and we gain affiliations with one group or another, and then we're trading alliances, and it can get quite political. And so it's all very interesting to me, and it keeps me occupied.
Well, that's for sure, because one of the ways I know you over so many years, besides being involved in these inner growth groups for yourself and your own quality of life, you're tremendously involved as a political activist, and that is huge, because most people either don't have the time, the energy, the money, because this takes a lot of energy. You're actually attending meetings, understanding issues, explaining these to others. And that's why I thought today we would really focus on something that you have been working on currently, and most people probably are hearing about in the news. The thing is, although this is a current issue, it seems to be an ongoing trend. So we're going to focus on what they're calling Fast Track, the TPP, which is Trans-Pacific Partnership, and TAFTA, the Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement. They sound great through the names, you know, it sounds so great, free trade and partnership. But we're going to go a little bit more deeply into perhaps the devastating effects these things could have. I would say the first time we were tripped up about this, maybe it's not the first time, but one that I recall in recent memory, is something called NAFTA.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what was NAFTA? What were some of the outcomes? And now let's talk about these new things they're trying to fast track.
Yeah. Well, you know, you allude to the what unfortunately has become commonplace in terms of the Orwellian doublespeak, right? You know, these days I look at whatever legislation is labeled, I look at the labels, and I assume it does exactly the opposite. And unfortunately, more often than not, that tends to be the case.
Yeah, like peacekeeping troops, for instance.
Exactly. So, so just to begin and set the record straight on these names or these labels here, you know, Trans-Pacific Partnership, right? It doesn't say anything about trade, does it? It's partnership. Partnership is technically a legal term, right? It describes relationships, you know, and affiliations and the nature of those things. And TAFTA actually is a little bit of a misnomer, and I'm a little confused myself. I think the name's already changed, or different names are being bantied around, as they did with what was it, with Blackwater and these different organizations, the Center for Western Hemispheric Studies, I think they changed that from the School of the Americas. That was nice, easy one to remember, right? And then they changed it to multisyllabic names. So same thing with this TAFTA, Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement. Again, it says free trade, but more accurately, it also goes by the name of TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. And that, I believe, is a more apt name for it, because, again, it's a legal term, and it speaks to investment, and it speaks to partnerships. And that's really what these things are about. You know, they're really about forming allegiances, alliances, and partnerships that transcend our nation states. And so, you know, whereas previously trade agreements historically are focused on lowering things like tariff barriers and encouraging trade, these things really, I think there's maybe a chapter or two that address those sorts of things, but they really serve to undercut many of our environmental and health and safety laws and a lot of regulations that we already have in place to the point where it allows corporations through one of the many mechanisms contained in these chapters, what's called the investor two-state a mechanism that would allow these corporations to sue municipalities, localities, states, and countries, if we, our regulations, our laws, should impinge upon their ability to make profits. Literally. This is literally what it says.
Getting quite bold. Say that again.
Yeah, yeah.
Just so our listeners can grasp the difference in what they're promoting as the intention to what actually the intentions or the outcome will be.
Well, you know, to try to be fair, I mean, what they would tell you is that, you know, if there's unfair barriers to trade or competition, right? You want everybody to have equal access to a market. That sounds reasonable, right? You don't want to have undue prejudice against one group or another if they can provide adequate services in some shape or form. But the thing is, what this does is it prevents us from self-governing. It prevents us from, and this is, by the way, I want to up front be very clear that this is very much a bipartisan issue. I say a nonpartisan issue. I was just at a meeting last night, a very right-leaning group, and I think they had a member from the Birch Society there speaking on this same issue, the fast-tracking of these agreements. And some of the mutual concerns have to do with our sovereignty, you know, our ability to self-govern. So we have three branches of government, right? It's legislative, judicial, and the executive branch. Well, this literally takes out our entire judicial branch. See, what happens is the 600 or so corporate lobbyists, I think it's more like 550, and that is made up of a handful of environmental and other union labor groups, who are the ones actually getting to see the text and develop the text within these agreements, will also make up the very tribunals that will that countries will need to go to contest. And actually, I'm mistaken, let's back up on that. Countries will not have standing. We can't go to these tribunals. Only the corporations can go to these tribunals when they want to contest some local, state, or federal law or regulation or ordinance that prevents them from making profits. So they bring it to the tribunal, and there's an outcome, and we have no standing. Now, I guess we'll get to this, but you know, I've been working with the town of Oyster Bay here. I presented at the town council the other day, and we quickly set up a meeting with their attorneys last Thursday. And right off the top, at first glance, they said their major concerns that stood out for them was the fact that we would have no standing. And what that means is these tribunals would not recognize us. We don't recognize you, therefore you can't even show up and make your case.
So wait a minute. This is really, really big. And I want to remind our listeners that we're listening today to Mr. Ken Schneider, who is, among many things, a political activist who is deeply studying issues that can impact us all. And our focus today is on discussing the TPP, or it might have some other I in there, but anyway, TAFTA and TPP, which they are trying to fast track. And when we say they, it sounds like the government and multinationals, but you are also working in your backyard level bringing awareness, because you're talking about the town of Oyster Bay, which I actually am involved with as well. So you're talking about talking to local politicians about something they would not even be perhaps even hardly aware of, because the voting about these things is not going on the local level. It's more of a national level. Is that correct?
Well, and it's being done in secret. That's the other thing of major concern. So this was released. The only reason we know anything about this at all is through WikiLeaks, released the initial couple of chapters in August of 2013. So, and there's one on investment, one on partnerships, and there's two or three chapters that were released. So I was surprised, right, when I went to the town board, and they, and then the attorneys later on in private said, yeah, they really didn't know much of anything about it.
And exactly, so, that's what I'm saying. But through your efforts, you're bringing it to their attention.
Yeah,
and
well,
unless someone else is doing this on a micro level in their area, most even town-level politicians probably have never heard of it, just like many people in our audience have never heard of it.
Yeah, well, there have been, you know, people who have been writing articles about it. I think it's Greenwald and, you know, a number of others, progressives, but also, again, right and left, you know, across the political spectrum, people have concerns about this. So information has gotten out, and I did hear about it about a year ago, but not in any great detail. So as you get more details, of course, it gets more alarming. So I went to the town council because this is part of an overall strategy. I'll quickly outline that for your listeners. You know, so these issues are so big. You know, it's like, how do we get our heads around this? How can we possibly have any impact on this? And quite frankly, the odds are pretty heavily stacked. But we do have somewhat of a strategy, and that is that there's a schedule here. And right now, this is expected to go up for a vote in the Senate by around mid-August, mid-April 13th or so.
Well, that's like around the corner.
That's what the nature of fast-tracking is, that it's fast. So,
okay. I just want to announce something because you sent me a wonderful link, because I know this is a complex topic. Even in our hour show, people may not understand everything. So a great video that you sent me, Ken, is called StopFastTrack.com. Yes, there are two T's next to each other. It's StopFastTrack.com. So if you want to learn more about it after today's show, that's a good place to go. But what does fast track mean, Ken?
Well, there's a long history for this, too, but in a nutshell, it just would give the president's authority to put it up for a vote in Congress, both the Senate and the House, and it means that there are no amendments or any objections of any sort allowed, no questioning, no, you know, dialogue or conversation about it. It's just a yes or no vote, just right up for a vote, so it's either up or down. And April 13th, word has it that, you know, it's expected to pass. If it goes to the House, then the strategy would be that if we pass these resolutions locally in cities and towns around the country, this way we could at least have some leverage with our representatives in the House, letting them know that there is strong opposition to this in our municipalities. That being said, there is still hope in the Senate, and I want to make this clear, because in terms of what people can do, right, because again,
it always would say that, yes.
Yeah, so let's focus on, you know, what is possible. So one thing that your listeners can do is call the White House switchboard, and I can give that number if you would like. That number is 202-225-3121. I'll give it a few times when people get paper and pencil, because I know whenever I'm listening to the radio and they give a number, it's like, wait, I didn't get my paper and pencil. So we'll give that again in a little bit. But you call the White House switchboard and you ask to speak with state representatives in New York, right? That's Gillibrand and Schumer. And then your local representative for me in District 2, this is Peter King here in Oyster Bay. I live in Massapequa. And then the other person whose office you want to speak with is Ron Wyden. Now, who's Ron Wyden, and why do you want to speak with him? He is a Democrat from Oregon, and he is on the Senate Finance Committee. And I'm not even clear specifically. It's Orrin Hatch is the majority Republican chair on that committee, and he's the minority chair, I believe, on there. And he's a key vote. And it really is essentially the linchpin that if he goes along with this, It's really going to send a message. And the president and Orrin Hatch want him on board. So if he goes along with this, it probably will go a lot smoother for these guys because it'll send a message to the Democrats that, you know, all systems are go. And if he opposes it, then we have a much better chance. And right now, my understanding is he is holding out. He's looking to get a better, smarter, fast-track bill. but the point here is, it's not good either way, right? The essence is that there's no committee process, no amendments, only up or down a majority vote. So we don't want him going for any form, better, smarter, or otherwise.
We're going to take a little break right here. And when we come back, I want to go into some more deep information about what these bills could mean. Talked about, they're not really trade agreements. How do they violate our most fundamental principles of democracy? The fact that they've been done in complete secrecy. There's no way we can even read what's in this bill.
Sure.
And the new regulatory bureaucracy that they are creating. So, okay, listeners, you can stand by. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse. And Dr. Z, you can always find us at naturalnurse.com. And we'll be right back with more.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss Sar sarsaparilla, or Smilax officinalis.
Sar sarsaparilla is a tropical plant which grows in South America, Mexico, and Guatemala. Although most Americans are familiar with it as a flavor enhancer for root beer, it has also been used for its beneficial properties for hundreds of years by many different cultures. In Roman times, the young shoots were eaten, and the mature vines were worn as garlands at festivals of Bacchus. According to ancient Roman writings, Sar sarsaparilla originated when the beautiful maiden, Smilax, was turned into a shrub after her love was slighted by the young crocus.
Sar sarsaparilla was brought to Europe in the 16th century by Spanish traders. A French physician, Nicolas Monardus, published a comprehensive account of Sar sarsaparilla as a treatment for syphilis in 1574. During Portuguese military operations in 1812, a British inspector general of hospitals noted its positive effect on syphilis patients. It has also been used in China for treatment of the same condition. Sar sarsaparilla was included in the United States Pharmacopoeia until 1950 as a recommended treatment of secondary syphilis.
Sar sarsaparilla's medicinal action appears to be a result of binding bacterial endotoxins in the gut, thereby decreasing their absorption. This greatly reduces the stress on the liver and is likely responsible for its historic use as a tonic and blood purifier.
In a controlled study of 92 patients published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1942, a chemically active component of Sar sarsaparilla called sarsaparin greatly improved psoriasis in 62% of the patients and resulted in complete clearance in 18%. Sar sarsaparilla is often recommended by naturopathic physicians for gout, arthritis, and psoriasis. Another folkloric use for Sar sarsaparilla is as a tonic for male sexual potency.
So, if you want a root beer flavored tea with a long history as a healthy tonic, reach for the Sar sarsaparilla in your natural medicine chest.
That you are interested in hearing about right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And, of course, one of the wonderful things about Progressive Radio Network is the fact that everything is archived. So that is something that you can tell your friends if you're enjoying finding out more about what's going on in our world, which we're talking today about in terms of these up-and-coming fast-track trade agreements. And if you don't like the way they're going to impact you on a personal level, you can have someone else tune in and listen to the show at any time. Today, as our guest, we have Mr. Ken Snyder, and he's an occupational therapist, massage therapist, and a medical and healthcare advocate, and a political activist. So we are talking to him today about some of these fast-track agreements. He just explained to us, thank you, Ken, by fast-track, it means they're going to bring it right to a vote without anyone being able to read the verbiage of what it says. Is it true that whoever is going to be voting on it also has never seen what it's about?
Well, no, it's a little bit of a misnomer there. I mean, initially, that was the case. Again, our members of Congress had to petition and protest in order to get to read it, although to this date, we're having difficulty finding out exactly who has actually read the text. The only person I'm aware of right now is Alan Grayson, Democrat down in Florida. There are others, but it's very difficult to find out exactly who has read it. And when they have read it, they've only been allowed to read it in guarded rooms, and they're not allowed to talk about it, and they're not allowed to take notes on it. So anything we know about it has been leaked, primarily by WikiLeaks, and then presumably, at least verbally, by indirectly, by some of the people who may have read it.
So doesn't this violate fundamental principles of democracy?
You think? you would think that, you know, to have a democracy, a functioning democracy, right, you need an informed, educated, engaged populace, right? I mean, how can we participate otherwise? So, yeah, it's a prerequisite to a functioning democracy and self-governance, of course. Yeah, I wanted to before we get to the specifics here, I just want to give that number again for the White House switchboard, because this is about not just having a nice conversation, but about inspiring some action here.
The White House switchboard and stop there, because our show is listened to. We have over 110,000 podcast listeners, so they're all over the country and the world. So you don't need to give these specific state reps. They can find that out.
Okay. All right. But the number again is 202-225-3121. 202-225-3121.
And I'm going to post that after our show description today. Mm-hmm. So people have that, you know, readily available for them anytime they want to, you know, tune in to any issue. And then once you get there, you can easily find your state representative.
Yeah, and then there are some other resources I understand you'll post in the archives around, you know, getting sample resolutions that have successfully passed. The one I'm using that was recommended to me through the Alliance for Democracy was a Richmond, California resolution, and there are others in Seattle and a few other places that have passed. So I use that as a template when going to the town boards, so we don't have to reinvent the wheel and start from scratch.
Town boards are putting in place saying that they oppose the use of such as TPP and TAFTA locally? Is that what they're able to say? I mean, since this is more of a national
issue? I'm sorry. You're asking what the boards stand as of now?
Yes, exactly.
But they are relatively uninformed. So right now we're in the process of informing them. The attorneys, they asked for their specific concerns. We're getting the actual text to them, right, because they're attorneys. They want it from the horse's mouth. They don't want to hear, you know, hearsay through articles and so forth. So I've gotten them everything I could find, which is only amounts to two or three, no more than four chapters that have been leaked of the specific text. And what they told me was that their main concerns, just at a brief look, was that we don't have standing in these tribunals, that we have no recourse, can't go to local, state, federal, Supreme Court, is all irrelevant. None of that has standing. And the impacts, and we'll get into what you want to talk about here, local zoning laws and land use laws, okay, and the extent to which this can impact on our ability to protect environmentally sensitive areas, encourage sustainable development, protect locally owned businesses, limit sprawl, and exclude or limit or regulate polluting industries and businesses that may overuse local resources, such as water, and prevent us from protecting our health and our environment. And essentially, besides not having a standing, the other huge thing about this is that we can be sued if we don't line up, if we don't harmonize. That's the term they're using, right? Harmonize means essentially mandating conformity, right? In other words, you may have specific rules, regulations, ordinances, and laws in your local area that are there for a good reason, because you know the specifics of your area, you know what's important to you, and this is saying, no, no, you got to get in line with the same rules and regulations that are in China, that are in Vietnam, that are in South Korea or Thailand, wearever. It basically, I remember Noam Chomsky had a phrase. He said, bringing home the third world. Well, this is the concrete on-the-ground form of bringing home the third world. What this does is this really levels the playing field. All right, so we'll be competing in every way with people in other countries, but it really brings us down to the lowest common denominator.
A Chinese company, let's say, if they wanted to come and farm Oyster Bay for oysters, because it's a great place for it, it's where most of the oysters that are sold in the Northeast are farmed and gathered in the wild, they could set up, let's say, a business there doing that, even though right now it's blocked by local ordinances.
I don't know enough about oyster mining, so I can't really comment specifically on that, but something that does come to mind would be workers' rights, right? So in terms of competition, you know, they could pay their workers whatever they wanted. They wouldn't have to abide by any, minimum wage standards if theirs are set up in a particular area. So all these efforts that we've been making over the last decade or two or three would all be wiped out. You know, fracking, you know, all the rules around the hydrofracking, you know, and these chemicals they've been putting in, all these local ordinances, all these would be irrelevant. That they are now making the rules, and the same people writing the rules would be in these tribunals, and they would go back and forth, just like we have revolving doors between corporate CEOs, like say Cheney at Halliburton becoming vice president, going back and forth between companies and corporate the government and corporate boardrooms. Here you'll have attorneys already are setting up law firms to work on contingency, and you have lawyers going from those sorts of groups to being prosecutors on tribunals, being judges on tribunals, back into the law firms that are working on contingency to process the cases. I mean, it's so it's really outrageous. But the point here being that there's this term they use, regulatory coherence, right? They want to, and harmonizing. You know, very beautiful sounding terms, right? It sounds like the harmonic convergence, doesn't it? But what it has to do is lining up and mandating conformity to the lowest common denominator. So the financial crisis, the extent to which we have, not that we have many regulations in place, no Glass-Steagall, and other mechanisms that were in place, all these things would be irrelevant. They would be considered, any regulation would be a barrier to potential profit-making. So it just makes another financial crisis even more likely, not to say that it's not already the case, but if you had any doubts. Also, local jobs, public health, again, as I said, with jobs, if there's sweatshop-free zones or buy local policies, for example, in order to protect, worker jobs or to protect the cleanliness of our food supply, say goodbye. You know, it wouldn't be those rules and regulations anymore. It would be the lowest common denominator. You look around the world and see, you know, what's the least amount of regulations, and that's what it reverts to.
Right, and we have seen that happen. I mean, what is the history? Because I know when they were selling how wonderful NAFTA, which is an older bill that's already in place, was going to be. What have been the ramifications of that, since that's something that we have a history with?
North American Free Trade Agreement?
Right.
the guy at the meeting last night here, and again, I'm usually not hanging out with, you know, right-leaning organizations, but here I'm listening to this guy from the Birch Society, and he was talking about one of the richest guys on the planet here down in Mexico. I forget his name. You might be familiar with it, the telecom guy. So he did quite well after NAFTA, And so here you got the rise of the Mexican elite. And now he's one of the major donors to the Clinton Foundation, is what my understanding was from this gentleman. So to whatever degree that may or may not be true, that is the principle. You know, and it's the same as it works here in the United States, except now on a global level. So you have people making the rules for the benefit of a few, and then you have that. You have an economy, okay. You got a really flourishing economy at the top, and you got money circulating at the top. So that's one of the outcomes here, where, you know, in capitalism, right? The cap means head. You know, money flows to the top, and that's pretty much what's happening. So we have that divide.
That's amazing. They can actually trump local regulations.
Well, that's the big thing. Yeah, local, state, and federal. Yeah, it basically nullifies our judiciary branch. Now, we'll still have a judiciary for resolving conflicts within the United States, but in the case of any transnational corporation or corporation within the United States or outside of the United States would be operating within this supranational tribunal system, not a judicial system.
It reminds me a lot of the Codex Alimentarius, which are the food laws, where they talked about global harmonization. And one of the aspects in that, which actually has come into play, is that the United States can sue other countries if they don't accept genetically modified food.
Yeah, there's a lot of history to this, and there's a lot of presidents, right, that have been. There's a long list of prior trade agreements that this is based on. Yep. Those are examples. Yeah, and again, this isn't just goods. It's also services, and this is also a little different. I mean, this impacts healthcare as well. To the extent that federal and state governments attempt to reduce the cost of medicine and drugs, the American pharmaceutical corporations obviously do not want that, and this allows them once again to challenge such policies. And such to the extent that even the AARP, which doesn't traditionally get itself involved in discussions of trade rules, for example, have written the president expressing concern about proposed rules, which would increase the length of patents. And I heard some outrageous numbers as far as the number of years somebody could hold a patent and prevent at least our government ability to negotiate and mandate lower drug prices in programs like Medicare, Medicaid, for veterans, seniors, the poor. So, again, if anything we're doing is seen as an obstruction to their present or future potential, profit-making potential, they can bring suit under these tribunals, and we have no recourse and no standing.
Wow. And I'm wondering, perhaps our listeners are wondering, why does it need to be fast-tracked? Why can't they, allow the verbiage that would be in these agreements to be widely available for review and discussion?
Well, there's a short and a long answer. I'll give the shortish medium answer here, which is, you think of cases like, sexual abuse or something, and they say, okay, I can see there's some reason to have, some confidentiality and protect people. But in this case, right, if you want a democratic, there's a big presumption there, right? If you want a democratic process, if you want people participating and engaged in the process, then of course you value transparency, accountability, oversight. But if you have a specific agenda that you suspect the majority of people would question and likely oppose if they knew the details, then, of course, you want to keep it secret. So, yeah, and then there's the conundrum, of course. It's like, well, we really can't say because we can't see it. We can't participate. So it's a chicken and egg sort of thing. And it's got to deal with the attorneys. It's like, well, before we draw up a resolution, we got to see the text. Yeah, we can't see the text because it's a secret. And so the very first meeting I said to him, I said, all right, listen, if nothing else, if we can't get the information that you want, then will you at least be on board to write a resolution saying that we're concerned about secrecy? Because, to do our due diligence, right, to serve our citizens properly, right, we would need to have access to this information in order to make informed judgments and decisions in our best interest. So at the very least, even if you're in favor of this entire thing, as an attorney representing a town, it would be malpractice not to, at the very least, support a resolution opposing it simply based on secrecy alone.
Yeah, that's right, is the fact that no one can even read what's in it.
Right.
So it sounds like what we always, you know, those of us who have been aware, have always known is coming down the pike. By the way, you can look at stopfasttrack.com, and I also have links to Alliance.
I think that's .org, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, you might be right. Okay. So Fast Track, it's stopfasttrack.org. Okay. And what you also sent was links, which I already have posted at the end of our show today for those of you who go online at Progressive Radio Network, the issues that are laid out by Alliance for Democracy. Now, it sounds like sort of this giant takeover by corporations to basically run the world. And, of course, there is a movement in Congress right now, clearly indicated by the Republicans. They come out and say that they want to decrease regulation, get rid of EPA Clean Air Act regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I don't know. Of course, they always link it to that it will increase jobs. But how about that it'll decrease air? Don't their children have to breathe? I don't get it, Ken.
Well. First of all, the jobs thing is a total red herring. I mean, you know, if we were, I have long said, it's like, I don't understand this thing with the solar. If we provided incentives, tax incentives and rebates and so forth for people to put solar panels on their house, right, what would you have? You'd create jobs, you stimulate the economy, right? You'd be having people producing energy everywhere. If you're a free marketer, imagine this. Imagine everybody's producing energy, and anybody who produces excess energy, rather than selling it back to the power company at wholesale and then they resell it to other people at retail, you put a little transformer or your telephone pole, and you can sell it to your neighbors. So you would have everybody producing energy where it's being used. So you're not transporting it, so you're decreasing the carbon footprint. You have to transport gas and oil around the world in planes and boats and trains and trucks. And you produce it where you use it, and everybody is a producer selling it to everybody else. Talk about free market. But, of course, that won't happen. Why won't that happen? Among many other things, it's because the power companies, right, own the power grid, right, and they have no interest in that. You know, and keeping it centralized. I tell you, quite frankly, I went to a forum years ago at Massapequa High School here on Long Island. I went with an open mind around the wind turbines off the coast of Long Island here. Long story short, I went, you know, supporting it with an open mind, and I came away not wanting it. And it's not not in my backyard sort of thing, although there were those people there. But it was Florida Power and Light. The old CEO of Lilco was down in Florida, so there were some political connections there. But the point is, it would be centralized again, that this company was like a 15-year contract, and after that, all bets are off, right? And then they can do anything they want. They're responsible for maintaining the infrastructure, charging rates, and so forth. So the idea that it's corporately centralized, right, whether it's wind turbines or, you know, electrical power plant or whatever it might be, whatever the generation of the energy, wherever it's coming from, some are better than others, obviously, some are worse than others, but being still centrally and corporately owned and controlled is a major problem in my mind.
Well, you know what? We actually have to take another break right now to allow Progressive Radio Network to tell everyone about the great shows that you can listen to 24/7 right here on PRN.FM. And when we come back, we'll tie up our discussion about TAFTA and TPP. Ken, and we'll talk about some of the other wonderful services that you provide, such as quality of life extension. So we will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. online, come through naturalnurse.com, or in person, show up at any of our lectures or presentations. We have classes in Chinatown where you can learn about tongue and pulse diagnosis, participate in Qigong in the park, and have a day where you feel like you left and went to another country. You can also join us for outside herbal identification workshops where we learn how to make wild plants into medicine. And those are locally at Restoration Farm, which is a beautiful CSA. And also we have online courses in herbal certification. We also have medical offices in Connecticut and Oyster Bay, Long Island, where you can come in for your own assessment, and we set up a natural protocol for you. And those can also be done online and by phone. So visit naturalnurse.com to find out more. Today we have as our guest Mr. Ken Snyder. He is an occupational therapist, massage therapist, and medical and healthcare advocate, as well as a very active political advocate, informing both the public and public officials about issues that are important to quality of life. And we talked today a lot about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement, which are coming up, and they're being fast-tracked. If you want to find out more about that, listen to the rest of the show. But now we're going to talk about other things that Ken is involved with in his professional life. And he wanted to talk in terms of quality of life extension services. So tell us about that.
Actually, that was a clever segue. I appreciate that. Going from quality of life and how these supposed trade agreements would limit our ability to self-govern and our independence in determining our quality of life on many different levels. So really my professional background is in occupational therapy, and I've also been a practitioner of nonviolent communication for the last decade or so, as well as a health and medical advocate. So I'm working in home care with people who are dealing with end-of-life issues. And the idea of quality of life extension isn't just about extending life, but extending one's quality of life, which is what most of us cherish most deeply. So if there's someone living alone, independently, and they have some progressive conditions such as dementia, Alzheimer's, work with a gentleman with metastatic prostate cancer who had his cognitive facilities but was in a good amount of pain but still wanted to do the things he loved to do. My services are designed to provide assurance to families and their loved ones that they are safe, first and foremost, and maintaining that optimal level of independent functioning as much as possible for their condition and their circumstances, and affording them the opportunity to remain engaged in meaningful, purposeful, goal-oriented activities that they most enjoy for as long as possible. And I like to say, under the best conditions, might even get a chance to check off some of those things on a person's bucket list, you know. And then additionally, I provide services to family members as well. You know, obviously it's a stressful time for people, and to watch a loved one, skills and faculties deteriorating and losing their independence, their autonomy, want to maintain their dignity, and family members have their own concerns and stressors in managing all that as well as their own lives. So I provide services to families as well to provide support to them to make the task more manageable, less traumatic. And quite frankly, again, you know, under the best circumstances, a lot of these challenging situations can really serve, in some cases, to even heal and bring families closer together. So it really can be a very cherished time for everyone when it's done well.
Act as an advocate and also increase communication, because I find so often as a nurse, and I've been involved with people who are at the end of life, which of course is a natural part of life, that a lot of times the other individuals involved, the family members, they'll sit there and talk about, oh, well, next Christmas we can do this, when really there's, you know, of course, God can always intervene, but in all likelihood, the individual will no longer be there. So they're in a state of denial instead of talking, let's say, about something that would be more supportive of that person, like all the wonderful things they've done together before.
That's one of many examples. Absolutely. The dynamics are infinite. The most recent one I've encountered just the other night, I was kind of on call for a couple of sisters whose father has a heart condition, but you know, I already had met with him previously. He was very clear about wanting to stay in his home, not being afraid of dying, not wanting people coming in. And, you know, so he was very clear about what his values and priorities are. And so I really felt that it was the sisters that really needed most of the support around, you know, listening to the father, getting clear about what was important to them and their fears. You know, and I asked them, I said, well, you know, and then you have a decision to make, you know, how much are you concerned about his safety and preventing him from dying when we know, you know, that that's inevitable? And how much are you concerned about the quality of your connection, your relationship with your father in at this time, you know, and for whatever amount of time you have left in relationship with him? So in that respect, you know, helping people make, well, prioritize, get clear on what their needs are, the needs of others, have compassion for one another, and address what they're really wanting and needing at that time. And this is in addition to traditional occupational therapy services, you know, dealing with primary prevention, you know, doing environmental adaptations, modifications, or people need, you know, grab bars or scatter rugs cleared, you know, clearing the environment to make it as safe as possible, doing energy-saving interventions, just, you know, lowering beds or having shower chairs or proper handles on doors and so forth, and basic just instruction in best practices for activities of daily living. So if people are still, you know, more often than not, they're not cooking for themselves per se, but hopefully they're still self-bathing. You know, they're doing some basic activities of daily living. If they're not doing their own laundry or so forth, they have somebody, you know, coming in doing that for them. And then also just making sure people have access to the community, getting them out and about, engaged in their activities that they make life worthwhile, as well as engaging and continuing to engage in, you know, social and emotionally fulfilling activities, interacting with peers, and as you kind of alluded to, you know, going through a photo album and just, you know, doing a life review and having that as a family activity in the spirit of what you mentioned there, you know, just really connecting with what's most important. And then in the advocacy realm, you know, there's really three areas I consider: healthcare, medical, and personal advocacy. And then healthcare, it really is just some basic things around just basic self and environmental awareness, considering one's physical health, diet, nutritional supplements, medication, interactions, which I'm sure you're quite involved with yourself, and how these affect, or and how they can affect mood, thinking, and physical and daily function. And so just being aware of that. And then what most people are pretty consumed with at this point in time is the medical, you know, medical appointments. So as an advocate, as a medical advocate, make sure their medical appointments are timely and appropriate, that they're getting the appropriate referrals, ensuring that they have access to all available services to which individuals and families are entitled. And then there's also the quality assurance piece, right? We want to make sure, again, that there's transparency, accountability, and oversight with our physicians, because yeah, they got some competing priorities as well, and we're not vilifying physicians here. We're just recognizing them not so much as the experts, but as human beings, you know, with their own needs and concerns and pressures, and so we're interacting with them in that spirit, you know, cooperatively as team members. And for a lot of people, especially older folks, you know, that might be a difficult thing. So to have a medical advocate to assure that we're minimizing the medical error and ensuring that interventions are as safe and in their best interest as possible. And then the last piece in terms of the personal advocacy, I already kind of alluded to that. You know, I just want to help people get clear on what their priorities and their options are, and want to empower everybody involved, both the individual and family members, to make you know, conscious, consensual choices, you know, kind of do a cost-benefit analysis and see, you know, which direction people want to go.
Now, Ken, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you? You shared with me you don't actually have a website, but I'm sure you have a way people can get in touch with you if they're interested in any of these aspects that we discussed today.
Yeah, I prefer, unlike many people, still using the phone. So I'd be happy to give out a contact phone number. My number is 516-943-4396. I'll give that one more time because I know when I'm listening, it's always too quick. So it's 516-943-4396.
Thank you so much.
And that's also my name, kensnyder2@hotmail.com.
Okay, email kensnyder2@hotmail.com. We're out of time, but I will tell you, listeners, if there's any other information you'd like, you can always get in touch with us through Progressive Radio Network, where this show will be archived, as well as naturalnurse.com, and we'd be happy to share any of those links or information with you. So, Ken, thank you so much for being our guest today on a very informative show.
Thank you very much for having me on. It was a joy.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us once again right here on Progressive Radio Network for The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. On behalf of myself and my co-host, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, I'd like to tell you to stay healthy.